Okay, so as the continuation of my lecture yesterday, although in this lecture, in yesterday's lecture, I talked about a very specific implementation, NMR, in some kind of detail, not great detail, but a little bit of detail. Today I want to talk about several different implementations in very, very low-level detail, just to hopefully give you a kind of a flavor of what's going on. I mean, so now it's 2009. This field has really been going on for about 10 years. A lot of these experimental approaches, these drives to build the basic building blocks of quantum computers, didn't really start in earnest until about no more than 10 years ago. In some cases, even less than 10 years ago. So, kind of where are we at today? And in particular, I'm going to focus on three approaches that I think are very promising. But again, I won't really talk about any of them in super great detail, just to hopefully give you a kind of a flavor of what's going on. In fact, the first half, I'll be talking about technologies which I've heard a lot about, and I've gone to a lot of talks and read papers on them, kind of kept up, but it's not my field per se. So I'll try to answer any questions you might have, but don't expect me to know every detail about those approaches. And then the last part, I'll talk about quantum dots, which is actually a field that I'm starting to work in myself, so I hopefully know a little bit more about that. So this is by no means an exhaustive list, but there are some promising approaches for scaling up involving cold atoms, solid state, and nanoelectronics, and of course optics. And I think that Barry Sanders talked about optics, I think, and also these cane-type devices, a big approach that's going on in a big effort that's going on in Australia right now. So I'm going to talk about today just a little bit about trapped ions, one of the cold atom approaches. Just very briefly about the state of the art in superconducting qubits, and then a little bit about quantum dots and the effort to build spin-based qubits and quantum dots. And of course, in terms of computational models, we know that there are a number of models in addition to the kind of standard model within circuit-based QIP. There's also measurement-based, which involves, you know, the creation of these entangled cluster states and then measurement and feed-forward techniques. There's this new idea of topological quantum computing, which is somehow kind of in between circuit-based and adiabatic, I guess, in a way. And Matt Hastings kind of touched on this a little bit yesterday in his talk. And then, of course, there's adiabatic quantum computing, which is the approach that's taken by this company D-Wave out in Vancouver, you may have heard of, who are, by the way, implementing that with superconducting qubits. So this is a slide from a recent program review from IARPA, which is one of these defense funding agencies in the U.S. And this is just an indication by year and number of qubits, the progress of multi-qubit experimental demonstrations in five different technologies: linear optics, neutral, and trapped ions, superconducting qubits, quantum dots. And so you can see that, I guess people were able to just observe two-level spin states back in the 80s, and since then you can see that there's been and particularly since the year 2000, a pretty steady sort of upward trend in the number of qubits that can be controlled and the kinds of entangled states that can be prepared. So I guess the state of the art, for example, in ion traps right now, which I'll talk about a little bit more, is the creation of 6 and 8 qubit entangled states. But in most of these systems, well, in all of these systems that you see on this graph, at least two qubit control has been demonstrated. For example, square root of swap and quantum dots, and now Grover's algorithm on two qubits and superconducting system was just published this year, so kind of gives you a rough overview of where we are beyond one qubit in a number of these technologies. And so now I'll talk a little bit about trapped ions, which again, I'm not an expert, but I actually borrowed some slides from Dave Wineland at NIST, who was kind enough to send me a few slides from a recent talk that he gave. And this is one of his first slides, where he's just listing the number of groups working on trapped ions, pursuing quantum information in the world. So actually, there are more groups doing that than I thought. Most of the results we hear about are really coming from two or three top groups, but there are a lot of people pursuing this. So the basic idea of ion trap, well, first of all, you have to trap the ions. So this is just a schematic of a linear trap. And these cylindrical things are segmented electrodes. So they produce DC and RF electric fields. So if you just have DC electric fields, it turns out that it's impossible to confine a charged particle in three dimensions. So two of these electrodes, you have an RF, a rapidly oscillating electric field. And the way I've heard this described in talks is that with the DC fields, you can create a sort of a saddle potential, which is confining in maybe one or two dimensions, but then is sort of anti-confining in the other dimension. And what the RF field does is sort of makes the saddle potential rapidly rotate around. So it makes an effective three-dimensional confining potential. So you have a linear array of ions which are trapped. Of course, they form a kind of a linear array because of the Coulomb repulsion between the ions. Then, of course, you have to cool down their motional states. And that's where the technology of laser cooling, you know, which has been used to make Bose-Einstein condensates and all of these nice applications with cold atoms. So, you know, you shine lasers, and there are these well-known techniques for, you know, removing phonons from the system until you really get down to the motional ground state of the system. So this, so you trap some ions, you cool them down to their motional ground state, and then you can manipulate the internal states of the atoms with lasers also. And, you know, you have a couple of choices for qubits. One would be involving optical transitions. Those don't tend to live as long as qubits involving a nuclear spin, or so-called hyperfine qubits. So I think the direction that most people in the field are going now is to encode this quantum information really in the nuclear states using these hyperfine qubits. And this is where ion traps have an amazing advantage over almost every technology, because you have these ions sort of sitting there in space. It's not really interacting. It's not in a solid state. It's not interacting with much of anything, just being held there by an electric field. And so the relaxation time for these atomic states, in particular hyperfine states, is effectively infinite. It's very, very long. And amazingly, coherence times are typically seconds at least, and in some cases have been observed more than 10 minutes, or on the time scale of minutes. So in this sense, and when you think that quantum information, quantum gate operation is something like a microsecond, then this is effectively an infinite coherence time. So from that point of view, this was one of the original sort of motivations for trying this approach way back when it was first proposed, the basic scheme by Serac and Zoller in '95. So that's a powerful motivation. Yes.
So are there different electronic states on the calcium ion?
So these optical qubits, different electronic states, like ground state, excited state, if you're talking about optical qubits. In this hyperfine case, you're talking about the manifold of states which differ by a nuclear spin state. Okay. So you have long coherence time, you have the ability to do single qubit manipulations just by shining lasers, or in this case of hyperfine qubits, the difference in energy, the qubit splittings are typically in the microwave or the high radio frequency range, and so you could use microwaves directly, but actually I think what people do here for selective addressing is that they use two lasers which have a difference frequency, which is in this microwave range, so that they can just directly drive qubit transitions just the way that I described yesterday in NMR with a resonant field. So that's all very clear. And then then the question is, how do you couple two qubits? And so that's where this scheme of Serac and Zoller back in 95 comes in. And they had a really nice idea. I won't go into detail about the physics, but you can look up this paper if you want to understand how it really works. But the idea is that, you know, say you have two ions in this trap. They can be, they don't have to be neighbors. They can be any two of the ions. You shine a laser on one of the ions with the laser frequency very close to one of the qubit transitions or atomic transitions, but detuned by an amount, by a frequency, which corresponds to the center of mass motion of the ions in the trap. So if I go back here, oh, I guess I don't have it on this slide. Oh, yeah, on the slide. So all of the, so if you, there are different motional modes of the ions in these traps, right? So one mode would be where all the ions just slosh back and forth together, and that's the center of mass mode. Modes where the ions are moving apart are called stretching modes and so forth. So there are, you know, a number of different modes. But these modes now can be populated. They're well-resolved quantum states. So we can populate this mode with 0, 1, 2, 3 phonons. And so as I said, when you start, of course, you want all this, the motional mode to be in the ground state, the sort of 0 phonon state. But if you shine a laser on the atom and you just detune it by an amount that corresponds to the energy of adding one phonon to this mode, then you can make a transformation like this. This indicates ground and excited states of the two atoms, M and N, or the two ions, and this 0 and 1 represent the state of the center of mass mode, having 0 or 1 phonons. And so in the first pulse, you apply to the Mth ion, and you excite a transition here for this particular state, or for these bottom two particular states, from the excited state to the ground state, but then adding one phonon in the center of mass mode. Then you can apply a pulse on the second ion, which reverses the sign of one of these states, and then you can go back and apply the first pulse again, and that removes the phonon from the system, and what you end up with is a controlled phase gate between the internal states of these two atoms. And so this is a really neat scheme. And it's been implemented already for a long time in these systems. Measurement is also works really well in these trapped ion systems because of what you call cycling transitions. So if these two states here represent the internal qubit state, maybe the hyperfine states, there are some much higher lying electronic states, which you can resonantly drive with the laser and very rapidly relax down to the ground state. And there's some kind of spin selection rules, which means that this can only relax to this qubit ground state. It never relaxes to this state. So that means that when you apply this resonant radiation, if the qubit is in the ground state, then it looks bright. It scatters many, many photons. And if the qubit is in this state, then it looks dark. So it's like a dark state for that resonant radiation. And so with this, the discrimination is really so good that you can get measurement with very high fidelities. And so these are just some pictures of some of these linear traps, what they actually look like in the lab. Because the motional frequencies, you know, from the way I just described the way gates are done, you put a phonon in this center of mass mode. And so the ultimately the gate speed really depends on how fast, what are the motional frequencies in these traps. So if you make the traps smaller, then you get higher frequencies, faster gates. So so these traps are, you know, fairly small. I mean, they're not microscopic, but they're on the sort of millimeter length scale. Yeah, I should say that actually, I don't know what the typical distance is between the ions exactly, but I think it's on the 10 to hundreds of micron scale. So that's why it's easy to actually shine a laser. Lasers, you can focus down to something like 2 microns spots, and so it's easy to shine a laser on one ion and not hit the other ones. because they're actually maybe a bit further apart than you would think, something like microns. And this I will skip over. And just a list of some of the experimental demonstrations that people have done in different groups. So Deutsch-Schoss algorithm, which I just mentioned yesterday in NMR, just a simple two-qubit algorithm. Grover search, quantum Fourier transform, things like this. And then more recently, these entangled states involving 6 and 8 qubits have been demonstrated at in Austria and at NIST. So I don't know, a lot of neat things going on in the field there. And so the next step, so I showed you this picture of these linear traps. The direction that this all seems to be going is to trap ions using what are called surface traps. And the reason for that is because ultimately what you want to do is not just have one linear array of ions, but you want to be able to move ions around between different zones and have sort of multiplexed trapping with a lot of the different zones. And so that's what you can do with these surface traps, and that's what people are working on now, sort of creating a lot of different zones where you can actually move the ions around. Actually, I'll describe that a little bit in the next slide. But these are just some nice pictures from the different some of the different groups that are making these. And you can see they have sort of different approaches in terms of materials and design, but it's all the same basic idea. You have these sort of surface electrodes. Rather than having the electrodes sort of surrounding the trap, you put them all on the surface, and it may be a little bit counterintuitive, but you can still create a trapping potential that way. So the ions are actually floating above the surface, and then you can sort of move them around. You have all these segmented electrodes, and you can kind of shovel them around by changing the voltages on these electrodes. So this is sort of the idea. I mean, if you want to think about going towards large-scale processing with arbitrary numbers of qubits, you need to be able to transport the qubit between locations. You need to be able to do repeated single multi-qubit gates, for example, detection and state preparation. So this is just sort of a schematic of the kinds of things that you want to do. So, one of these sort of yellow bars indicates a trap zone, and you want to be able to move qubits between zones. And so, you can think about applying if you have these segmented electrodes, you can easily imagine constructing sets of voltages such that you can just take a potential and just shift it along the surface of the trap and just push an ion. Okay, so the idea is that you might have some ions in some places where they're sort of far apart, and you do individual operations, and then you want to bring them together to do two-qubit gates using this center of mass mode operation, and then you move them apart and maybe move them around and bring two other qubits together, things like that. Oh, I don't know. It's just a picture. And then another tool that I think that that they're looking to use in these systems is that actually you have a lot of these hyperfine states, and some states are better for certain purposes than others. So, for example, if you have a qubit that you want to store for a long time, you could use this manifold of states, because it turns out that this manifold is insensitive to magnetic field fluctuations. And so coherence times in that manifold have been shown up to 15 seconds. And actually, I'm not really sure about what the reason is here, but you might choose these two states for doing two-qubit states. And then another set of states might be better for state detection, maybe because this state is further from resonance with the readout pulse that you use to excite the transition from the ground state. So maybe you get a higher readout fidelity for these two states. So the idea is, you have these kind of multiplex trap arrays where you shuttle the ions around. Of course, the big problem with this shuttling around is that inevitably when you move ions around, you excite their motional states. You can't keep them in the ground state no matter how hard you try. And so when they get to their destination where you want to do some operation, maybe some 2-qubit or 1-qubit operation, you have to remove the heat that was generated during this transport. And so the idea is that qubits will always be associated with sort of ancilla atoms, which are used as refrigerators. So as I mentioned before, for the initialization of this trap, you want to cool all the ions. And that involves using these laser cooling techniques, which influence the internal states of the atoms, right? So if you're storing information in a qubit, you can't cool it directly. But what you can do is you can use a process called sympathetic cooling, where you let it come into sort of thermal contact with another ion, and then you laser cool that ion. So effectively, you can remove the phonons from your qubit without shining laser on it directly. So that's kind of the idea and what people are working towards there. Some of the challenges that were mentioned in this IARPA report, these are very technical challenges. So just take it with a grain of salt, but things like crosstalk, this ion heating is a problem that needs to be solved, although from a recent talk I heard from someone in NIST, apparently they're able to do this quite well now, so they can actually make ions sort of go around corners and only add maybe about on the order of 10 phonons, which can be removed by this sympathetic cooling. So actually, I think they're pretty close to being able to do this. But as I mentioned, the next step is being able to do everything on these surface traps and just sort of getting all the lasers and all of the control hardware in there will be a challenge. All of these traps are just operated at room temperature, right? So the surfaces of the electrodes, even though the atoms are at some very, very low temperatures, nanokelvin, something like that, effectively, the surfaces, these electrodes are just at room temperature. So I think the next step with a lot of these systems is to cool down the electrodes to cryogenic temperatures, and that will help a lot with this heating problem. So now just very briefly about superconducting qubits. Here's a very partial list of groups working on superconducting qubits. I'm sure the list is much bigger than this, but these are the only ones that I could sort of come up with off the top of my head. So this is probably the field that I'm least expert in, but I know that there are three types of qubits. And these are formed from Josephson junctions. So Josephson junction is just a sort of a tunnel junction between two pieces of superconductor. And there are two main energies associated with a Josephson junction. One is the Josephson energy, which is related to the supercurrent, the superconducting current that flows through the junction. And the other is the charging energy, which is charging energy of this, thinking of it like a capacitor. And so there are three main types of three ways that you can sort of have qubits in these superconducting systems where you have these Josephson junctions. The Josephson junction, by the way, is the only nonlinear, non-dissipative electrical element that exists. So that's why it's really interesting. It's a nonlinear. It acts like a nonlinear inductor, and it's perfectly non-dissipating. With these two main energies, in the regime that the Josephson energy is very large compared to the charging energy, then there are two types of qubits, phase and flux, which you may have heard of. And then the other regime where the charging energy is very large, then you have a charged qubit. And in this phase and flux regime, the qubit is really a much more macroscopic object, right? Because a flux qubit, if you think of a flux qubit, well, you can think of a device that makes a flux qubit as just being a ring that's interrupted with a Josephson junction, so at least one. And so you have a sort of a circulating current, persistent current. And if you adjust the operating conditions just so, you can make the left circulating and right circulating macroscopic supercurrents degenerate in energy, and then those form the basis for your qubit. And what's really neat about that is that, you know, this involves really the collective motion of a macroscopic number of electrons, you know, something like 10 to the 20 or so. Now when you're at the opposite regime and you're looking at charged qubits, the charging energy is the dominant energy, and that's the energy to just add one Cooper pair. Okay. And so when you look at charged qubits, you're really the state of the qubit, it's sort of like well, sometimes it's called a Cooper pair box. It's whether you add a Cooper pair or take one away. And those form the basis states of your qubit. So in that sense, the qubit is really a much more microscopic kind of thing. I mean, it involves this whole device, right? But then the qubit states are just the difference in adding and subtracting one Cooper pair. Whereas in this case of flux qubits, it's really the collective motion of many, many electrons. And so I just put this here because I wanted to show the relationship to the NMR stuff I was talking about yesterday, because at the end of the day, when you go through and work through the math on these circuits, what people always end up with is a description of the qubit, which can be written in a kind of a quasi-NMR language with spin operators. So for this flux qubit and the 0-1 basis, there's a very simple effective Hamiltonian to describe the ground state and first excited state, and we can ignore the other states because this is a nonlinear system. And so you see there's just a term proportional to sigma z, which is the energy difference between these the states of the right and left circulating current. Kind of think of that as a detuning, which you can tune experimentally. You can set it to zero. And then there's this second term, proportional sigma x, which is just the tunneling term, the strength of tunneling between the two states. And both of these can be controlled experimentally. One can use just DC pulses to implement qubit rotation, single qubit rotations, or if there's an energy splitting between the two qubit states, you can just use direct radio frequency pulses to excite the transitions. And so now there have been some newer work where people kind of try to optimize the conditions that are somehow in between charge and phase. And these are some of these that you may have seen papers on. One from the group in Saclay called Quantronium, and one from the group in Yale called Transmon. And for a very good review that talks about sort of the basic types of qubits and the basics of superconducting circuits, I would recommend this review, Superconducting Qubits, by Zagoskin and Blaze on the archive. So so yeah, I won't go into really much detail at all about this, but this is just a couple of recent experiments that have been done by the Yale group with these transmon qubits, which are these hybrid charge phase qubits. So they're basically charge qubits, but they're in this regime where the Josephson energy is actually larger than the charging energy, and so they derive some benefits from this in terms of getting longer coherence times. And then what they've done is that they've actually embedded these qubits in a superconducting resonator, so it forms a cavity. So what they've been doing the last few years is looking at circuit quantum electrodynamics, circuit QED, and things like being able to couple two qubits via some virtual phonons in this cavity. So this is really neat stuff. I probably shouldn't go into the physics of it too much, but I think the basic idea here is that they're working in the dispersive coupling regime in this particular paper, so that the qubits are only coupled dispersively to this cavity, and so you can effectively turn the coupling between the qubits on and off by just adjusting the resonance frequencies of the two qubits. So if the two qubits have the same resonance frequency, then there's a degeneracy between these two states. So the up-down and the down-up states of your two qubits. And here, the 0 and 1, again, represent the states with 0 and 1 photon in the cavity. So if you bring these qubit states into resonance, so that they're degenerate, then you get some virtual photon transition through this state here, where you see that flipping one of the qubits or the other qubit, they would both give us this down-down state with one photon in the cavity, and so you get a virtual transition through these states. So if you start with a up-down, then you get a swap to a down-up. So this is basically like a swap gate, and then you can turn it off by just detuning the two qubits. So you change omega 1 with respect to omega 2, and that's something that they can do experimentally just by changing the magnetic flux through the qubits. And recently, with pretty much the same setup, this group has shown the two-qubit Grover algorithm by coupling the two qubits in this way. So they are able to implement these steps for the Grover algorithm and then do some state tomography. And so I think they ended up with... So the final fidelities of the answer at the end of the experiment are something like 80 or 85%, which doesn't actually sound that impressive at first, but then when you talk to the people doing the experiment, actually it turns out that this error is essentially completely due to relaxation, due to T1 of their qubits. So the actual control itself, in terms of the control pulses, are very good. I mean, probably 99.9% fidelity, something like that. I don't know exactly. But essentially, all of this infidelity is due to T1. And this is really the big challenge with these superconducting surrogates, is that I guess there are material issues when you form these Josephson junctions. There are always, I guess, the potential for some kind of defects, charging centers or two-level fluctuators in the tunnel barrier. And people suspect that that might be responsible for these relaxation and decoherence times being shorter than we would like them to be. But if these can be increased, then these systems are extremely viable, extremely easy to scale. So it's a really neat approach. So now I'll talk a little bit about quantum dots. So there are a number of groups in the world that have done a lot of the pioneering work. In particular, Marcus Group at Harvard, Cohen Hovind's group at Delft, people in Tokyo and other places, and now I have a research group at IQC that's working with some quantum dots. So the basic idea that sort of stimulated this field was a proposal made back in 97 by Lawson DiVincenzo. And the idea there was to form an array of singly charged quantum dots. And what the device they had in mind was one of these 2D electron gas. It's a semiconductor heterostructure where you have a two-dimensional electron gas about 100 nanometers below the surface at the interface between two types of semiconductors. Actually, it's just gallium arsenide and aluminum gallium arsenide. So we have this two-dimensional electron gas, and you can put surface gates, just electrodes, on the top surface of this device, and you can imagine creating potential wells in this, creating a two-dimensional potential in this two-dimensional electron gas, so that we create little puddles of electrons. And the idea is that you can actually, by tuning them electrostatically, you can remove electrons down to where you have just one electron in each dot. And there you can imagine using the spin or the charge as a qubit. Well, say you have a double dot, then you can imagine using the occupancy of the dot as a qubit, right? You can have, you know, whether the electron's on the left side or the right side. That's a sort of a charged qubit. But of course, you know, it turns out in a solid state that charge noise is kind of the dominant noise. So charged qubits probably don't have very good coherence properties. So a much more attractive idea is to encode the quantum information in spin, because spin is only very weakly interacting with the environment. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So the idea is, you know, let's say we have an array of these single electron spins. Here, you know, I mean, these gates forming this potential is really a lot like this ion trap. I mean, really the purpose of it is just to trap the single electron. And once the electron's sitting there and it's confined, it's sort of in a box, then you use its spin as your qubit. So, and of course, we can implement single qubit gates by implementing single electron spin resonance. It's not so straightforward experimentally, but I'll give you some examples of, actually now a lot of examples of this being done. And then the other feature of the system, which is sort of particular to this proposal, is how you do two-qubit gates. So we take advantage of the exchange interaction between neighboring electrons. And so I won't go into too much the details of it, but it's actually, the exchange interaction is actually due to the Coulomb interaction between two electrons and the fact that they have a non-vanishing wave function overlap. And that's something that we can control. So for example, in this picture here, you can see these middle gates create a potential barrier between the two dots, preventing electrons from tunneling to one dot to the other. But if we lower that barrier a little bit, then it turns out that we turn on an interaction called exchange interaction, which is really, as I say, due to the Coulomb interaction. But because electrons are fermions, it creates an effective spin interaction, which looks like just S1 dot S2, so spin operator of electron 1 with S2. So it's a Heisenberg-type interaction. And it turns out that as we lower this potential barrier, then this J, the strength of this interaction, turns on exponentially. So this interaction can really be turned off essentially perfectly, and we can turn it on. And the gate times, if you do some sort of back of the envelope calculations, the gate times can be very fast. So sort of like picosecond, hundreds of picoseconds time scale. So really the challenge here is to be able to implement this and to control it very well, and then also to achieve some sort of single electron spin resonance that hopefully is somewhere in the same ballpark in terms of the speed. So these two-qubit gates between neighbors can be done very, very quickly, but it's not clear how fast, at least in the beginning, maybe it wasn't clear how fast this electron spin resonance can be done. In the first experiment, certainly, that was the part that was taking much, much longer than the two-electron, the two-spin gates. Okay, and then initialization and readout. Well, those are pretty straightforward because we can go to, of course, these experiments are done in the dilution refrigerator, so done at very low temperature with the magnetic field turned on. So we have automatically that the Zeeman energy is much larger than thermal energy. So this is exactly the opposite of the situation that we had in liquid state NMR at room temperature, where KT was much, much, much larger than this energy. So this means that if we just wait some time, the spins will relax into their ground state, and we have initialization that way. And so if KT really is small compared to this energy, then it sort of looks like this energy diagram I've drawn here, where these gray bars represent the Fermi energy of the electrons in the leads. This, of course, represents the quantum dot. And this is the ground state and excited state energy of the spin. So the same orbital state, but a different spin state. And so if this KT if temperature was a lot larger, then these energies would be smeared out, and there's no way that you could resolve the difference in this spin-splitting energy. But if KT is much smaller, then obviously we can just adjust the level of the dot so that if an electron was in the spin-down configuration, for example, then it can just tunnel out, whereas the electron in the spin-up configuration would stay in the dot. So you can see there immediately that we have some basic way of doing readout and initialization of the spin state. So so the idea is attractive in the sense that it's solid state. I mean, ultimately, it would be nice to think that we could build a quantum computer that, in some sense, is like the computers we have today. That we have chips that rely on solid state fabrication technologies. And the other piece of physics that really makes this appealing and possible, really, is that of course in these semiconductors, not in all semiconductors, but in the 3-5 semiconductors, which a lot of these devices are made, one has a spin orbit interaction, and in the bulk semiconductor, that spin orbit interaction relaxes the spin very quickly. But actually, when you confine the electron, you raise the energy of the higher orbital states, and that suppresses the relaxation of spin by spin orbit. And so, in a confined situation, the spin orbit relaxation time is on the order of milliseconds at least. And when we compare that to gate operations that are on the hundreds of picoseconds or nanosecond timescale, then that's really a long time. And I didn't write it here, but then the other piece that goes along with this is that that Loss showed in a theory paper as well that the decoherence due to this spin orbit relaxation mechanism is at this limit that T2 is equal to 2T1. So in other words, the decoherence due to spin orbit mechanism will not be any faster than T1. So that's also on this millisecond timescale. Unfortunately, that's not the only decoherence mechanism in these devices, but at least we know that from that point of view, the spin could be considered a good qubit. So progress in few electron quantum dots. Of course, before quantum information came along, people were making quantum dots and trying to get down to single electron just to study the physics of it. And some of the pioneering work came from workers in Japan who made these vertical sort of pillar structure devices, which again were involving heterostructures of semiconductors. So these were really the first devices where people were able to get down to a very few number of electrons all the way down to zero and show that that was really the case. Then this proposal by DiVincenzo and Loss, I think, has driven a lot of work in these gated two-deg devices. So just the same one I was describing before, where you have this two-dimensional electron gas and these top gates. This is just an AFM image of one of these devices, the top gates on one of these devices, and it's designed for a double dot, so a dot in the left side and the right side. And of course, recently there's been a lot of work in exploiting systems, one-dimensional systems like nanowires and nanotubes for making quantum dots. This is a schematic of some work from, I think, a while ago now from Marcus's lab in Harvard, where they apply this top gating idea to a single carbon nanotube, and they can form a dot or a series of dots. And the similar ideas have been implemented in semiconductor nanowires. So a lot of the sort of big results in this field came out around 2005, 2006. with work that was done in these gated two-dimensional electron gas structures. And so one of the big advances was showing the coherent control of the exchange interaction. It's done by Pet et al. And the group at Harvard. So the system that they were studying here was a double dot where they could have one electron in each dot. This diagram here, the experimental diagram, shows what's called the charge stability diagram. So as a function of the gate voltage on the left side and the right side, it adjusts the occupancy of the dots in terms of the number of charges. So in this yellow area, you have only one electron in the right dot. In this area, you have zero and two electrons in the right dot. Here, you have one electron in each dot. So this experiment is really carried out in between these two regions here, where you have one electron in each dot or two electrons in the same dot. So the basic idea of their experiment is to prepare a stage where you put two electrons. So you start in this region where you have two electrons in the same dot. And because those two electrons were occupy the same orbital state, they have to be in a spin singlet. So we know that when we start here, we start in a spin singlet state. So then one adjusts the gate voltage parameters to go over into this 1-1 regime, and that sort of corresponds to separating the electrons. Now you have one in each dot. And I won't go into the details of it, but you also have some effect of nuclear spins in these systems. And because of the effective nuclear field that's acting on these electrons, when you take that singlet state and you separate into into the two individual dots, you go into a ground state. You adiabatically prepare a ground state, which looks like spin down in one dot, spin up in the other dot. So we're no longer in a singlet state. We're in a state that just looks like up down, for example. And then one does some evolution, and then one can bring the system back into the 0-2 configuration to do a projective measurement. And the idea here is that we're making use of something called the spin blockade effect. So if now these spins evolve in such a way that they form a triplet state, so there are three triplet states, obviously that's the name. One of the triplet states just looks a lot like the singlet state, but instead of having a minus sign in between the two, maybe I should write it here. So the singlet state looks like up, down, minus, down, up. And the triplet state is like this. So omitting the normalization. So if I form that triplet state, then I'm actually prevented from tunneling back into this 0-2 charge configuration. Because of the Pauli exclusion principle, right? I have to form a singlet for both these electrons to be in the same orbital. The triplet for the triplet state, I would have to go to a higher energy orbital state, and that's much higher in energy, so it won't happen. So when I go back to this 0-2 configuration, or you know, I rapidly pulse back there, then if the electrons if the electron does tunnel over and I get the 0-2 state, then I know that I had a spin singlet. Whereas if the electron doesn't tunnel, then I know that I formed this triplet state. So this acts as a projective readout of the spin state in this singlet-triplet basis. So this is just an example of then what they sort of did with this system. Start with a singlet state. You adiabatically prepare this ground state, which just looks like up down, and then we bring the system back to I didn't really talk about it here, but as we go from the 0-2 to the 1-1 state, we're changing the effective exchange interaction as well. So the exchange interaction looks like this as a function of so detuning is the energy difference between the voltage difference between the voltage we're applying on the left and the right. And so this detuning, this line of detuning here, corresponds to a line going this way between 0, 2, and 1, 1. So right at this kind of crossing point between 0, 2, and 1, 1, I have very large exchange energy. If I go far into the 1, 1 regime, then I have very low exchange energy. So in the first part of the experiment, I go very far into the 1, 1 part. I have low exchange energy, and this is my eigenstate, up, down. But then I pulse back here where I have a large exchange energy, and when I have exchange, it's just because it's like a swap interaction, right? Because it's like doing a swap gate, because it's a Heisenberg interaction. So that up down starts to rotate towards down up. And then if I undo this adiabatic adiabatic input that I did in the beginning, then if I rotated it to from up down to down up, and then I redo this, then it actually rotates the state to this T0 triplet. And then when I do the readout, then I will see that I don't have both electrons in the same dot when I go back to this 0-2 configuration. And so that's what they did. So as a function of this, the time that this exchange rotation is applied, you can see these oscillations in the occupancy of the 0-2 state. And so that means that, that's a demonstration that coherently controlling this exchange interaction. And so the neat thing about this is that by optimizing the conditions, they were able to show sort of a square root of swap gate on the order of 180 picoseconds. So pretty fast. And then just quickly, the progress with respect to single electron spin resonance. So this was first done by workers in Delft back in 2005-2006. So the idea there was very straightforward. They had this same kind of double dot system, and they just went and put something called a coplanar strip line on top of it, something where you can apply an RF current. And so the current sort of goes around this kind of upside-down U-shaped junction here, and that produces a magnetic field that's going out of the board, so perpendicular to the plane of these two dots. And there's, of course, an in-plane external DC magnetic field. And so this is just like the NMR experiment I described yesterday. You have a magnetic field in the plane, which is constant, and then a field coming out of the board, which is oscillating. And so if it's at the right frequency, then it should induce spin resonance. And that's exactly what they see here. So as a function of magnetic field and RF frequency, for spin resonance, you should see just a linear dependence of the excitation ESR frequency on a spin resonance frequency on magnetic field. And so that's exactly what they see here. And it turns out that they're using exactly the same effect of spin blockade in order to detect this as in the previous work, except here the idea is that you start the experiment by sitting in this kind of spin blockade where you're in a triplet state, so you can't tunnel, so electrons can't tunnel through the system. Then we apply this microwave pulse. We have some probability of flipping one of the spins. If we rotate the spin, then it's going to have some projection along the singlet state, and so then it's going to be able to hop over into the right dot and then hop out into the right lead in this case. And so basically, the detection in this case is just that when you don't if you don't flip the spin through this resonance process, then you just see no current. But if I apply a pulse, I flip the spin, then I see some current. And so in a similar way, as a function of the pulse time, then you see these coherent oscillations in the current. And so this was sort of the first demonstration of single electron spin resonance. But of course, the time scale here is much longer than for the exchange gates. So these these Rabi oscillations are on the order of 100 nanoseconds, say 50 to 100 nanoseconds, maybe 50 in the best case. Another practical problem with this approach is that, well, I mean, this idea of just directly creating an RF magnetic field works really well for systems like NMR, but in this case, you have a charge trapped in your dot, and an oscillating electric field. If the if you produce an oscillating electric field around there, then that can easily provide enough energy to kick the electron out of the dot. And so that's exactly what happens. And so this experiment is really limited by the fact that you can't apply too much RF power and you can't go to too high a frequency. Otherwise, you just kick the electron out of the dot, and that's called photon-assisted tunneling. And that's sort of a limitation of this approach, and actually made it quite a heroic experiment to actually go and do. It turns out that there's another way of generating spin resonance in these systems, which is much more friendly in, from this point of view of photon-assisted tunneling. And the idea here is that we can actually use the intrinsic spin orbit interaction in the material as an effective magnetic field. So that's called single electron electric dipole spin resonance. So normally we can only drive these spin transitions directly via magnetic field. Here we actually apply an oscillating electric field, and what it does is it sort of shakes the potential well of the electron back and forth. And because there's a spin orbit, I won't go into the details of it, but because there's a spin orbit interaction in the material, that creates an effective oscillating magnetic field through the spin orbit interaction. And so actually, people in the same group in Delft did this a little bit later with the same device. And so they were able to show that just by applying an oscillating electric field, and because of the way that the geometry of the spin orbit interaction, the oscillating electric field has to be in the same direction as the applied magnetic field, then you can do exactly the same experiment. And you see, again, coherent oscillations. But now you can do the experiment at much higher frequencies, sort of in the gigahertz range. And in fact, this approach is different from standard spin resonance in the sense that now the Rabi frequency of this of driving spin resonance is proportional to the external field. So as I go to higher and higher frequency, my Rabi rotations actually get faster. Of course, if I go to too high frequency, then again, it's going to be much easier to just drive the electron out of the dot due to this photon-assisted tunneling. But the difference here is that you're actually not really putting putting really power into the system. You're just applying an electric field by modulating a gate voltage. So you're not really driving a large power in the electric field here. So that's why you're able to go to very high frequencies and still not run into this problem of photon-assisted tunneling. So this is a neat approach, and in principle, if you do this kind of thing in a material with a very large spin orbit interaction, then you could maybe expect to have Rabi oscillations kind of on the few nanosecond timescale. And then the most recent work that was done in this direction was kind of the same idea, but rather than using the intrinsic spin orbit interaction of the material, you actually make a kind of an artificial spin orbit interaction by putting a micromagnet very near your device so that you have a very large magnetic field gradient along the dot. And then you can imagine that you get much the same kind of effect. As I shake the dot back and forth, then I get an effectively AC magnetic field, which drives spin resonance. So this was done by people in Japan at NTT and University of Tokyo. And so here they use, you can see, very much the same kind of readout scheme, taking advantage of this spin blockade effect. And this is exciting because this actually gives you sort of an engineered way of doing it, for material systems where you don't have a spin orbit interaction, like carbon nanotubes or silicon quantum dots. Yeah, and just as a kind of a, so I have to tell you a little bit about what I'm working on. This is just a recent a nanowire-based gate-defined quantum dot device that we recently fabricated in my group at Waterloo. And so these are kind of devices that we're looking to study in the near future. And the idea here is to have arrays of single electron quantum dots where we can manipulate the spin states and use these ideas like electric dipole spin resonance and control of the exchange interaction to try and show that we have a universal quantum control. So so the main challenges for these quantum dot spin qubits and the materials that have been really successful so far in terms of demonstrating the basic ideas, these have all been using 3-5 semiconductors like gallium arsenide, indium arsenide. And these are very nice electronically. Because of the band structure of the materials, this idea of spin qubit works really well because spin qubits are well defined. Unfortunately, all of these 3-5 materials, no matter which one you pick, has 100% nuclear spins. And I didn't really talk about it here, but that's the main decoherence, the main obstacle to having long-lived coherent states in these systems, the presence of this nuclear field, which kind of acts like a random field and sort of diffuses over time and sort of causes a lot of problems. But actually, we have ideas of how to control that, how to mitigate those effects. So in those systems, one would have to learn how to control the nuclear spin-induced decoherence, or alternatively, follow some of these other ideas and develop devices and using carbon nanotubes, graphene, silicon, and so forth. The problem there is that sometimes these devices, these materials, they have a band structure that's sort of too symmetric. So so you get these sort of degeneracies, and spin qubit isn't necessarily well defined. But then people have ideas for how to get around this. So these latter approaches are a bit more challenging in terms of well-defined spin qubits, and the technology just isn't quite as developed for just how to gate them and make devices out of them, but actually there's a lot of efforts now toward these materials like graphene and carbon nanotubes. And these are some of the technical challenges that were mentioned by this IARPA report. So that's everything that I had to say. And just mention that there are a number of quantum information related tutorials with a couple of things on implementations like superinducting qubits and quantum dots on this website here, IQC, under tutorials. And if you have any further questions or comments, feel free to email me, bob@iqc. And thanks a lot for your attention.